Is that correct pronunciation of your name?
Yes, it is. Thank you. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Crown's appeal presents a very narrow issue under the doctrine of equivalence relating to one limitation, one claim, one patent. There's no dispute that the application of the doctrine of equivalence and the Graver-Tang function way result test presents an issue of fact, is an issue of fact. The district court granted summary judgment in this case that the accused product could not infringe the reinforcing beam limitation of that one claim under the doctrine of equivalence because the function prong of the Graver-Tang test was supposedly not satisfied. Now, this court in the Toro case held that when applying the function prong of the Graver-Tang test, that not every function mentioned in the patent specification was necessarily relevant or central to the application of the doctrine of equivalence. I don't think rights and disputes in this court's cases hold that the determination of which functions are central or important to the application of the doctrine of equivalence is also a question of fact. The district court in this case, in the face of conflicting evidence regarding the functions, ruled that there were three relevant functions and that Crown had failed to present evidence with regard to two of those functions. We submit that there was conflicting evidence on that point because Crown's expert, Martin Hyam, had filed an expert report in which he identified what he believed to be the relevant function, which was of the reinforcing beam, which was to provide strength to the cannon.
But basically, you're saying that it's not a subject for summary judgment. There's an issue of fact that needs to be tried.
That's right. And that's the argument we make below, and it's the fundamental argument that we make here, and that is that Mr. Hyam's expert report, where he pointed to a single function and attempted to show why that function was satisfied in the accused product, should have precluded summary judgment. Now,
but would that happen every time that there are dueling expert reports at summary judgment, though? Like no summary judgment could be issued because there's a difference of opinion at that point?
Well, I think on the question of the function way result test, the way it's typically carried out from my experience is that the experts address the subjects, and in many cases that is the evidence. I suppose if an expert report didn't address all the questions and the questions were factual and material to the issue and dispute, that might be...
Counsel, maybe I'm cutting off prematurely, but I thought your answer to Judge Garza might have been, in this case, there were no dueling experts. Both your expert and their expert said this was the one and only function, and it was only a manufacturer of attorney argument that was supposedly...
That is the case in this case. Your Honor, I didn't mean to cut you off either. I'm sorry.
No.
3 weeks before Brexton's motion was filed, their expert... And I'm going to quote from his expert report. He said, Mr. Hyam says that the function of the conventional anti-peaking bead is to increase the pressure resistance of a seam-on cannon. And then skipping a little, he said, I agree that one of ordinary skill in the art of cannon design and or manufacture would view that as the function of the bead. That's in Appendix 3077. So going into the summary judgment.
It's hard to say there's no dispute of fact when both experts actually think this is the function. And only the attorneys say it's not.
What happened here is that when the summary judgment motion was filed 3 weeks later, Wrexham put into their opening brief, in the argument section, the attorneys pointed to sections in the patent specification that they believed created additional functions. But if you looked at the statement of facts in their brief, they nowhere said that those functions were essential or material to the analysis and that Crown had no evidence on that point. And so...
I thought that was the thrust of their argument about why it was pertinent that there were three functions.
Well, I think it's very instructive to look at the statement of facts in the three briefs that the district court had in front of it when it decided the motion. their motion started with a statement of facts that never addressed these functions. And they never
do address it in their legal argument.
They do address it in their legal argument, but their burden on summary judgment on this issue was to show that there was no evidence, that Crown had no evidence on an essential element of Crown's case.
Well, but under Celotex, all they have to do, since they're the moving party without the burden of proof, and you're the party with the burden of proof, all they have to do is to point out, I think that's the language of the Supreme Court, to the trial court the absence of evidence of some element that you're required to prove, at which point the burden shifts to you to introduce evidence, point to evidence, that is to the contrary. The question, this is why the waiver issue is pertinent in this case, the question is, did you acquit your responsibilities under Celotex to point out to the district court with specificity what in the record rebutted their pointing out that there were three functions, two of which were not performed?
Well, we did, there's also a preliminary point. We did carry out our responsibilities because in our responsive brief, we pointed the district court in four different locations to Mr. Heim's expert report in which he said the function of the reinforcing bead was to strengthen.
But you didn't flesh out that, but we didn't, there's only one function and here's the evidence to support it. That was what struck me as peculiar, that there wasn't any fleshing out. If I were the district court and the magistrate judge in this case, I would have been a little frustrated with not having this laid out for me, but that's with the kind of specificity that you've laid it out for us.
Your Honor, I think there's a reason why the district court might have been frustrated, and it had to do with two aspects of this case, the procedural posture at the time of the motion and the way the briefing went in. First of all, at the time of Rexham's motion, the court had not yet issued its Markman ruling. And so there was a great deal going on in the briefs because each of the parties were arguing with regard to two patents at that time and various limitations of the claims under both parties' construction. So there was a lot in the brief, there was a lot packed in. But secondly, if you go back and you look at the briefing, and in particular the statement of facts, what you see is that Rexham's opening statement of facts, the facts essential to its motion, never said that Crown lacked evidence on these two functions which it said were important. That was back in the argument section. In Crown's response in brief, it pointed out in the statement of facts that it specifically directed the court to the Heim expert report, and the brief said, Heim's expert report precludes summary judgment on the doctrine of equivalence, and it pointed to the relevant passages in his report. It wasn't until Rexham's reply brief that Rexham for the first time said, those two functions that we mentioned in the argument section of our brief are central or important, and Crown has no evidence. So the actual statement that should have put us on notice didn't really come until the reply. And that's how we got into this situation in which we find ourselves. Now, if we actually look at the specification passages to which Rexham points as supposedly central functions of this feature, what you find is that the specification really doesn't support either as a central function, which is the language of Torah. The first function that they point to is the function of supposedly providing an opening in the cannon in which the seaming chuck can fit. The way this works is the cannon sits there and a chuck comes down, turns, and causes the end to be seamed onto the can. Now, if you look at figure 5 through 7 of the patent, which is mainly one embodiment, the chuck doesn't enter into the opening into the reinforcing bead in that particular embodiment. So it can't be central to this invention that the chuck or the bead has to provide an opening for entry of the chuck, when in one embodiment it doesn't require any entry. It's clear from the specification. And if you look at column 4, lines 59 to 62 of the patent, it says that the chuck of the invention is, quote, designed to drive initially on the relatively large chuck wall without entering deeply into the anti-peaking bead, which is another term for the for the reinforcing fee. Now, Rexham and the district court found that that passage meant that the chuck had to enter the beam.
To some extent. Not equal.
But it's equally true that a chuck that doesn't enter the bead at all, as shown in figure 5 through 7, doesn't enter deeply in the bead. It's like saying, I don't like winter very much. That could mean, I like winter, but not very much. Or it could mean, it probably more likely means, I don't like winter. And so the district court and Rexham, I believe, misread that passage.
Okay. I suppose one could say that, I could say, going back to my chambers, that Mr. Heist didn't argue unduly long for an unduly long period of time. I think the clear implication would be that you did argue for a while. But I mean, there is an implication.
It's possible to take that implication, but not if you read that passage in conjunction with figures 5 through 7, which show no entry whatever into the chuck. There's no way you can take the chuck in figures 5 through 7 and move it into a position where it enters the bead. It can't be done. The other function that they pointed to, which is supporting the central panel, there's nothing in the patent specification to suggest that that's central or important, unlike the Toro case where the element at issue was pointed to as advantageous in the patent specification, and the court still found that it wasn't a function that needed to be satisfied under the doctrine of equivalence test. But even if we assume that supporting the central panel is central or important to this invention, it's almost beyond dispute that the fold in the Rexham end does in fact support the central panel. If it didn't support the central panel would fall into the beverage when the can was filled. Our expert, Mr. Hyam, looked at and testified in his expert report. He indicated that the fold surrounded the perimeter of the central panel, and he did a finite element analysis to show that it provided rigidity to the central panel. Now, there's no way
all of these arguments you're making right now, you didn't make below.
We did not make these arguments below.
You were on notice in their primary brief when they said there are two additional functions. If you were going to argue that, wait, there is a question of fact about one of those additional functions and whether it's performed by the accused device, don't you think you had an obligation to actually raise that before the district court?
If we had known in their opening brief that they believed that that was a central function of the...
They said there were three functions, and you keep using this word central function, and you actually said a minute ago, just so we're clear, that that's the language from Toro. The word central function, I cannot find anywhere. I do not find those two words together anywhere. Now, there might be. Maybe I'm completely overlooking them somehow, but I don't find them.
No, maybe it's not central function. I believe there is a word.
They talk about an insignificant function. But that doesn't mean there's one central function, and that's the only one we ever focus on when assigning or looking to the doctrine of equivalence. And I think that's an important distinction because it's a whole inaccurate characterization of the law.
I didn't mean to be inaccurate, and I would agree that there could be more than one function that's relevant to the doctrine of equivalence. But both parties seem to agree that there was one relevant function in this case. Both experts agreed. So at the time of the briefing...
Clearly they put you on notice. They thought there were two others, though. And you didn't address them. And I understand your point. But we did point to our expert report, which your argument is says one and only one. And I understand how you are arguing that and what it says. But these other two, the responses you're giving me now with regard to the other two, how do I not conclude that was waived? They clearly told you, we think there are three. They don't have to say we think there are three and they're central, because guess what? Our case law never used that word. And so for you to say we're not waived from arguing on appeal over the other two, which we never responded to, is troubling to me. If that's not waiver, I'm not sure when it doesn't.
Well, as I understand the Warner-Jenkinson case, or not Warner-Jenkinson, the Warner-Lambert case, if one argues the general issue below, which we did, our argument below is the precise issue we're making here, and that is that Mr. Hyam's expert report and declaration preclude summary judgment.
No, your argument below with regard to these facts was, as I understand it, there's one and only one function. That's how you want us to interpret your responses. But you never made any allegations with regard to a disputed issue of fact being created by whether their can does or does not pr- present itself as a structure. And that is a very, seems to me, straightforward factual argument that you just don't find anywhere below.
Your Honor is correct in that, at least with regard to the two functions in the patent specification that they raised on, they mentioned them in the argument section of their opening brief, but they didn't suggest that they were functions that required, that needed to be addressed in order to for us to satisfy our burden of proof until our reply brief.
What would be the other point of saying there are three functions that you don't perform? I mean, when they say there are three functions that you don't, and they don't perform all three, what else could they be suggesting?
What they should have said in their statement of facts under Celotex was, there are, Crown has no evidence with regard to these three functions. Had they said that in their brief, clearly in their opening brief, we most likely would have responded in our responsive brief. What we did in our responsive brief was to say there is one function, which is our position here. That's the position we advance below, and it's the position we advance.
Do you happen to have the readily at hand the citation of the place in their opening brief where they make the argument about the three functions?
I have it, and I see that I'm in my rebuttal time. Can I, bring it up when I respond?
Thank you. We'll preserve your
time. Forgive me, Your Honor, it's on Joint Appendix 2134.
2134, okay.
It begins there.
It's probably useful to have it open for that page because that's
I think so, Your Honor.
Very well, why don't we hear from you then, Mr. McAndrews.
I take it that I can make just one statement because there's a cross appeal on the marking. Can I dispose of that in a short paragraph?
Sure.
Your Honors are learned judges. I commit you to read Hansen. I don't care if Hansen...
They were bound by Hansen, but does Hansen make, clearly American Medical points out that there would be very little policy consideration that was met by going the direction of really what Hansen does. And I understand your argument is that's dicta, or even if it's not dicta, we're bound by the earliest pronouncement on this, and American Medical is distinguishable. I understand all of your legal arguments, but from a policy standpoint, tell me why in the world it makes sense. You can tell me my job's not to think policy, and I'll be okay with that, but I really want to know, you're a learned practitioner from a policy standpoint, why does it make sense to tell people that you don't have to mark your apparatus, just then assert the method claims? Because the notice function gives the patentee a benefit.
Okay.
They haven't put anyone on notice. What is the policy behind why the Hansen rule ought to prevail?
Well, first of all, it was stare decisis, and American Medical did not deal with those facts.
I know, I asked you to put all that aside.
All right, I will.
Tell me why Hansen is
here.
All right, let's assume American Medical stands for the proposition that you've got to mark it. What you do is cripple the patent system. Because what you then do, instead of putting both of your process or method claims and your product claims in the same patent, you file two patents. Very often the patent office will say, separate these into two patents. And then you'll have one patent that only covers methods and one patent that only covers products.
And if that were the case, you would clearly wouldn't have to stamp your method patent number on top of an apparatus.
That's right.
But that's not the case here. So you have a single patent that covers both.
And that was what was in Hansen. And we're entitled to follow Hansen until there is non-banking
ruling. Again, let's just talk about the policy since that's... Let's assume that we have free choice between Hansen and American Medical. You were beginning to go down the road of why we should follow Hansen and not American.
You started by saying we crippled the patent system.
Right. If you're going to change the law and cripple somebody that relied on Hansen, that's one thing. But if you're going to go to American Medical, which doesn't rule as a matter of law, just as a dictum, because that wasn't the issue before them, the only thing before them was I think it was just the process claims, I believe. I'll be standing corrected. But I don't think marking was necessary there. The point is, if you are going to cripple the people that relied on Hansen and put their product claims...
Assuming Hansen is not there, we're saying, imagine this is a case of first impression. I can't see any policy that supports creating a rule of law that you want. And that's...
Well, the policy is, I just said it, you'll double the burden on the patent office with the number of patents. Why would I advise a client to file a patent application with both process or method claims and product claims? They then have to, this marking is not an easy thing. You have to, as you see in this case, you have to follow the manufacturer. You don't know if the manufacturer is going to sell a product that infringes because the tooling is different. The product that we made for ourselves never went outside our offices. No one was injured by it. No, we made a few machines for our own use, kept in secret confines within the factory. What you're going to do...
I understand it's hard, but don't we want to encourage marking? I mean, isn't it really valuable for the competitive world to be on notice of the existence of the patent rights?
My answer still is no, because you'll double the number of patents. Very many patents have both product and process.
So what? The PTO gets fees for both of them. If your clients want to pay for two separate ones, hey, more power to you.
I'm not.
From a policy standpoint, I don't see how you can say it's bad policy to ask people to mark.
Your Honor, I'm not certain the patent office would agree with you at all that doubling the patent load is that's what they get paid for.
You're assuming that there's a method and an apparatus claim in every patent. So that's not the case.
It's actually
a rare patent that has the two of them together today for restriction reasons, just as you mentioned earlier.
Right.
So this is not a case in which we'd be doubling the load of the patent office by any stretch. Nor is it a case where everyone would elect to file two separate patents, as you're suggesting. Many people would either mark or cross that bridge when they come to it by giving notice.
Well, as I have said, the marking thing is not just simply walking up and stamping something. In this particular case, we didn't manufacture what the manufacturer did. The manufacturer said if they marked, it would be a violation of the antitrust laws because the product they were selling had many non-infringing uses. I think that's in our brief, all right? There are all sorts of reasons for it. And I'd like to think that's the reason the five judges, that really goes back to when this court was in its beginnings. I don't think that was an unbanked hearing. I think it was everyone getting experience with patent cases. Ordinarily, you don't have five judges sitting. I was intrigued by that. But I think that was the wisdom of what they did. And I think they said it is a narrow ruling precisely because it was saying if the product is being sold, okay, you mark it. If you're not selling the product, you don't have to mark it. If you're not suing on the product claims, you don't have to mark it. That was the narrow issue. They certainly weren't narrow just saying it had to come up through the Sixth Circuit. Read that opinion. I started out saying I'd have one paragraph. My one paragraph is that Hansen case is well-reasoned. It was by five judges. It's been relied on by patent attorneys all over the country, and the follow-up cases have no bearing at all until there's an on-bank hearing. That's my argument, and all I ask you to do is consider the ramifications of changing that law.
Now, on the doctrine of equivalence, can I ask you, what if we disagreed that the argument of whether there ought to be one or three functions was in fact waived? What if we view the response of Mr. Heiss's firm as sufficient to clearly be raising the issue by pointing to their expert and your expert, both of which talked about the function of this particular annular
That's interesting, Your Honor.
What if we were to say that we think that was sufficiently raised so that it's not waived? Because I understand your waiver argument. Now, if that's the case, why doesn't it create a question of fact as to whether there is, in fact, one versus three functions that need to be met by impugnment?
Your Honor, during the course of this proceeding down before Judge Stein, we told her that KSR had issued. We filed supplemental briefs. KSR is a strange case. It was based on summary judgment, and it was, they didn't remand it, the Supreme Court didn't remand it for a factual finding.
I'm confused. Why are we talking about KSR? That's an obviousness case.
And I'm telling you, the same principles apply here. Your Honor, these things are, frankly, if you go to the drawings on page 7 of our brief, on page 8 of our brief, I'm going to exaggerate just a little, but what their argument is that the giraffe is a mouse because they both have a nose and a tail. And I'll show you why. Here, if you will look at ours on page 7, it comes out to the very side and then goes behind the wall. Okay? Next time you pick up a soft drink, even here in the building, look down at a deep-seated channel and think of cleanliness. Okay? Think of cleanliness.
I don't understand what this has to do with the function discussion.
It has to do with why this is not even similar to what they did.
Holding with regard to summary judgment. We're here to consider whether there is a disputed issue of fact with regard to DOE, and the only holding below was function.
And we quoted from the patent specification very, very carefully on each of the three functions. And that's evidence. It's a government document issued with a seal. Under any rule of evidence, the patent is evidence.
I'm not arguing with you that there's evidence. Suppose we agree with you. Yes, you presented evidence. But so did they. They had not only their expert report, but your expert report. This isn't a case where we're considering giving them summary judgment. That's not what's on appeal. So it's kind of irrelevant whether you presented evidence. What's relevant is, did they present something that creates a dispute of fact over what you're alleging?
And I guess what
so
I'm
why
going,
we disregard their evidence.
I guess what I'm going to say again, if I may, what KSR has done to everyone in the patent bar is said judges have common sense. And if you look at what she ruled as the Markman ruling, you have what has always gone down. And if you will look on page 13 of our brief, you will see that the Japanese application had everything but the U-shaped channel that she said was required. You see figure 7?
Are you in the patent or in your
figure four?
No, I'm figure.
Figure 4 is the Japanese.
13, figure 4 in the center of the page, Your Honor, here. That shows the hook at the top, the 45-degree angle coming down, and a channel. Okay? I'm also mentioning again the cleanliness. Well, all they added was the old channel to the Japanese figure. Figure, the Japanese application is prior art. All right? Now, when you focus in on what they did, and then you look at the judge's Markman decision as to the necessity for that U-shaped channel, and then you look at our fold and you read Gillette's affidavit, and they even admit that he may have confused way and function. The fact of the matter is, he said there is no way a person of ordinary skill in the art would equate these two under any circumstances. Okay? He disagreed completely with Hyman. And now I'm still, forgive me for doing it, the Supreme Court said, when you have all of these elements in front of you, you have the patent saying there's three different functions or ways, whatever you're talking about, where it's clear that we do not have them, and there's good reason for not having them, all right? Then every once in a while you have to forget that it's fact, and judges have to use common sense. That was what KSR was. Stop issuing patents that anyone can see can't possibly meet those requirements. They didn't respond, I think, because they couldn't respond. Their patent, the very patent that we're talking about, digs a hole for them on those other requirements. And the judge found that those other requirements were necessary for their patent. They didn't appeal the finding of no infringement by direct means. They did this equivalence, and then we set out that the patent shows it can't possibly be equivalent. Gillette says very positively, a guy with 30 years experience, 20 years in this art, says that these are so bizarre, they're not even close. And forgive me, that's why I go to KSR. The Supreme Court has announced very clearly that common sense doesn't leave the district court judge. And I think at a certain point, you say the judge, even on a motion for summary judgment, can apply simple common sense.
Okay, can I interrupt you for just a moment with
yes.
a factual question? Turning to the portion of the joint appendix that we were discussing before with Mr. Heisman, where in your opening brief on summary judgment to the magistrate judge, where are the beginnings and the ends of what you submit for your discussion of the doctrine of equivalence issue, so that we know exactly what was in play when the document was presented?
Starting on 2134,
right.
And forgive me, it keeps going, goes very, very many pages. With drawings, highly detailed drawings.
Now, I'm talking about equivalence, not yeah. Literal. Only equivalence.
2136.
So it goes 2134 through 36.
Starting on 2123, the last paragraph.
Wait,
the doctrine
2123 or 2133?
I am sorry. Include 2123.
23 or 33?
No, I'm going to start with 2123 because the last paragraph starts talking about the doctrine of equivalence.
Well,
Maurice,
that's not the legal standard.
That's
the,
just the
Japanese.
Yeah. But in terms of the meat of your argument as to why there is why there's no equivalence infringement here, that we would find between 2134 and 2136. That's where you lay out the three functions.
Yes, Your Honor. The second full paragraph down on 2134.
Right, okay.
And if you read Gillette's affidavit, you will see that he doesn't use the term, but that the argument that they're equivalent is bizarre.
Counsel, one question I have for you, which is all of these briefs and the entire appendices, there's a lot of confidential marking. You know, it might all say confidential. Is any of this deemed confidential? When we write an opinion, are we allowed to get into this, or is this something the parties deem confidential?
Well, I'm going to take a risk right now. It is not confidential.
I think you're...
Mr. McCann?
Yes.
Just point out that under the court's rules, we did file a version of the joint appendix that identified by highlighting, I believe, portions that were confidential.
Right, but the problem is we frequently find that we need to allude to materials that are marked as confidential, but in fact, the parties don't really continue to regard them as such.
And on behalf of my client, I waive it as to what I've just pointed out to you.
Does Mr. Heiss have the same view as to that?
I think so. It would all involve their confidential information. I think it would involve it.
All right. Well, if If anyone has a different view, you can let us know by mail if you would prompt.
Okay, I will do that.
We assume that we don't have to steer clear of some of the material that's been so marked.
All right, Your Honor.
Is that a fair assumption?
Yes.
In all of the appendix, or just the pages that you referred to?
I'd have to go and compare it to the ones we went through carefully.
Your colleague may have a response.
It's difficult to say here. I think that there was relatively little that was identified in either the briefs or in the joint appendix as actually being confidential, and mostly it was quotations from the company's internal documents, certainly nothing discussing.
Okay.
I have one question which goes to the issue of jurisdiction. Counterclaim 1 was dismissed by the court. Is that correct? Your counterclaim 1 was dismissed by the court.
I believe that's true, Your Honor.
Was that dismissal ever incorporated in the final judgment in order? March 31st order.
I'd have to read it carefully. She was very, very meticulous in what she was doing.
Yeah, she may have been meticulous, but I think in this instance, she may have left something out.
She may have left something out. I know that there were revisions filed with the court, motions for corrections. I'd have to check that out.
Well, take a look at the order of March 31. It does not include. Says that the final order and judgment does not include the dismissal of your counterclaim. So the question remains as to whether or not counterclaim 1 was finally dismissed and so ordered, and a judgment was issued on that basis.
Your Honor, at 73 years of age, I plead ignorance. I'd have to check that out. I'm sorry.
Well, if we don't
could I have a few moments to confer?
If we don't have a final judgment, we have no jurisdiction for that issue.
Of the whole case.
Well, doesn't an order become final after 150 days, even in the absence of a final judgment?
I would like to adopt that. If it satisfies the other two judges.
Where to start?
I obviously didn't come prepared with the background.
Let me suggest this. I mean, I think Judge Garris is correct that there appears to be an omission from the document entitled Final Judgment, Amended Final Judgment Agreements. Perhaps the parties could give us some by letter. You don't have to file supplemental briefs of any length, but just give us your thoughts as to the proper way to proceed. Do you think that there's a provision? I think you'll find that there is. B, what consequence flows from that for purposes of our jurisdiction? And by that I mean, is it fatal? Can it be cured? Does it need to be cured? You understand?
I do, totally. Okay.
Well, I think the best way to handle that, perhaps, if that's
I learned in law school, jurisdiction is everything.
Well, and finality is important to
it is
jurisdiction,
indeed.
Even if on a technical point. Is that correct? Why don't we do that? We'll ask you.
All right. Yeah, thank you, and thank you for the extra time.
10 days. Very well. Mr. Heist, I think we promised you your rebuttal time.
I'll be brief, Your Honor.
You want to start by addressing Hansen?
Your Honor, Hansen did not, in the words of the UMC case, squarely address or definitively decide the issue presented by Rexham in this appeal. The issue that they framed in the brief was whether the district court misapplied Section 287A in light of the fact that Rexham only asserted infringement of method claims. The question is one of statutory construction, the question of law. That's from their brief at page 26. Hansen did not purport to construe the statute or
Certainly it did. It referenced 287. I mean, opinions don't need to use the magic words construing the statute to amount to a construction of the statute when it's a holding, and that holding can't be reconciled with what you're asking us to do in this case. It's nonetheless a construction of the statute de facto.
Your Honor, the holding in the case was, reading from page 1083, our decision is a narrow one.
This opinion addressed far more than just marking. There's a final conclusory paragraph, paragraph 4, which is not part of the marking section, which talks about the decision being a narrow one and says that we find none of the findings by the magistrate to be clearly erroneous. That is not a categorization of the 287 point as a finding of fact.
The magistrate had ruled in that case that there was a process patent at issue. In fact, it now appears that...
It's absolutely clear that that's not the case. So,
in fact, it was not.
There's no way you can argue that this court is saying the magistrate's finding that only process claims are at issue in this patent is not clearly erroneous, because the court in two different places, including the analysis described here, talks about the apparatus claims.
Your Honor, I didn't read the case as construing the statute. The issue that Rexham is framing in this case is whether another exception should be written into the statute. I didn't see that as something that was squarely addressed in the Hansen case. The way they would like to construe the statute is, in the event of a failure so to mark, no damages may be recovered by the patentee in any action for infringement. They like to insert the words, except in those actions in which the patentee elects to assert only its method but not its apparatus claims.
Well, we've already said in multiple occasions, as you acknowledge in your brief, that method claims don't require marking in order to be asserted. Now, what you would like us to hold in this case is, if there happen to also be apparatus claims in that patent, yes, they do. So you're actually asking us for a bit of an exception from our law.
What we're asking is that if there's something, which I think has been held before in other cases, if there's something to mark, the patentee should mark. In this case, there was something to mark. If it's an apparatus, if the patent has an apparatus claim, something patented, and that thing is sold, the policy of the law and the statute, I would submit in the statutory language, require that it be marked.
But we would argue that if the patent contained only method claims,
if the patent
nonetheless a commercial embodiment.
If the patent contained only method claims, clearly there is nothing to mark in the
statute. But you would be. I mean, you have a method claims that you have a device which is specifically designed to perform that method and can be used for no other purpose. It can only be used to perform that method. But I don't understand your position to be that you've got to mark.
That's not my position, Ron. So what I'm saying is, if there is an apparatus claim, and if there is an apparatus that's been sold, there is something to mark, and the patentee should not.
It doesn't matter that there's an apparatus claim. If there's an apparatus that's being sold, which embodies and exclusively embodies the method that's being used, why wouldn't the logic of your position suggest you must mark that?
Because the apparatus in that case is not a patented thing.
Well,
you know, somebody should be able to pick up the thing, and that should be covered by the claim.
And well, could you mark it by saying this apparatus forms a method covered by a patent, XYZ?
I suppose you could mark it that way. The statute makes marking permissive. It doesn't require marking.
So if you have two patents,
it poses a consequence for failure.
If you have two patents issued successively, one on the apparatus, the other on the method, the party asserting infringement comes in only with the method patent, no marking requirement.
I forget the name of the case. It's State. I believe it's the State case. It held that their patents are separate. Many times when there are there's a separate apparatus and method claim, it's because the patent office has decided that they're two separate and independent inventions. In this case, the patent office didn't hold that they were two separate and independent inventions. There's only one invention. Your Honor, if I may, the language that I should have used from the
quoted from the Toro case was non-critical. It didn't use the word central, but it did use the word non-critical, and I apologize if I misspoke. I also would like to call the court's attention to three pages in the appendix, 2122, 2132, 2330, and actually 2950. Those are the statements of fact in the underlying briefing, the opening brief, the response brief, and the reply brief. And what you will see is that the first time Wrexham indicated that the they felt that it was an obligation of our expert to address these additional functions was in on page 4950, in paragraph 10, on the reply brief. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, technically, Mr. Sanders has an opportunity for rebuttal on the cross appeal. Would you like to say anything further? The cross appeal.
I rest my case, Your Honor.
You certainly may. The court welcomes those words. Thank you. Giving back time to the court is always welcome. Thank you.
I'm a former law clerk from 1962.
Well, in that case, you know.
I do.
Thanks, Joseph. Until the case is submitted.